Tragedy in Turkey today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Twin suicide bombings at a weekend peace rally in Ankara kill more than 100 people.
Turkey has been profoundly shaken by this. It is the worst attack ever in Turkish history.
The Turkish government suspects ISIS. Many in Turkey suspect their own government. And everyone is asking, where's the president?
When a country is faced with something so horrific and would you think would want to have come together and heal or have some leadership, the top man is nowhere to be seen.
Plus, the tools it takes to win Bermuda's annual sand sculpture contest.
In my bag of tricks is a spray bottle, is an artist palette knife, a chopstick, and my most favorite one is a straw to blow out the detail work.
We go really granular today here on The World.
The World is brought to you with support from Audible.com. With over 180,000 audiobooks, Audible is a core tool for anyone seeking to be more productive, better informed, and thoughtfully entertained. Find out more at audible.com/theworld. And from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to start off with the news out of the Turkish capital Ankara over the weekend. You may have seen the video. One second, people are dancing at a peace rally, and the next, they're cowering in fear as a giant ball of flames erupts behind them. And that was just the first explosion. More than 100 people killed, some 600 wounded by a double suicide bombing at that rally. This ranks as Turkey's worst ever terrorist attack and prompted Turkey's prime minister to say today these attacks will not turn Turkey into a Syria. Still, the Syrian conflict has its way of leaking across borders. Earlier today, I spoke with my BBC colleague Mark Lowen in Ankara.
The hospitals were, of course, flooded with emergency cases among injured and seriously injured, some still in intensive care. We also went to the morgue today, and some bodies are still actually inside the morgue undergoing forensic analysis because they were so mutilated by the bombs that there's very little left to actually analyze. And among the bodies that are still there, or body parts that are still there, are the remains of the suspected two suicide bombers, who the Turkish Prime Minister says he suspects the number one suspect now is Islamic State, the group calling itself Islamic State or ISIL. And he's made a connection between the bombing here in Ankara and another deadly bombing in the predominantly Kurdish city of Suruç in southern Turkey in July that killed over 30 people and which was also blamed on Islamic State.
Why would ISIS want to launch an attack like this or the one back in July?
Because Turkey is now part of the anti-ISIS coalition, US-led coalition. Turkey was a sort of reluctant part of it for some time, not allowing the US to use its air bases here in Turkey. But a few weeks ago, Turkey relented. There appeared to be a deal struck behind closed doors between Ankara and Washington. So now some of the airstrikes against ISIS in Syria and Iraq are coming from a very big US air base in Incirlik, in southern Turkey. That, of course, led Turkey to be much more exposed to the ISIS threat. There was a video made by ISIS Central Command in Raqqa, directly threatening Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And it is thought that there was a threat to launch attacks in four Turkish cities. The problem, though, in a sense, for the Turkish government is trying to sell that narrative to a deeply sceptical public, because there is immense mistrust here in Turkey at the moment among vast swathes of the population towards this government, and particularly towards this president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is extremely divisive. You either love him or you hate him. And for those who hate him and for those who hate the government, they do not believe that IS is behind this. They believe that that is a convenient scapegoat, and they are instead blaming elements within the state or elements within the so-called deep state, as it's known here, which are basically murky nationalist groups that have often over the decades acted either in collusion with or in support of the government.
Today in Ankara, I gather funerals are happening for some of the victims from this weekend's attack. What kind of pall has that cast over the city? How's the city responding to the tragedy?
Well, Turkey is just in deep mourning. I mean, I was at a funeral yesterday, and it is absolutely tragic when you are there. The wailing, the sobbing, as people realized that lives were stolen far too early and in a matter of seconds. The youngest victim here was 9 years old in the bombing. Families have lost several members of their loved ones. One chap I spoke to, he couldn't speak because he was sobbing so much, and he simply said, "I wish I were dead too. To be alive to witness this is just simply too terrible." Turkey has been profoundly shaken by this. It is the worst attack ever in Turkish history. There is a rush to identify who was behind these attacks in order to reassure the country at the moment. But this tragic event will be seared into the consciousness of Turkey for decades to come.
That was the BBC's Mark Lowen in Ankara. As Mark said, the fallout from this bombing extends well beyond Ankara. Residents in the southeastern city of Diyarbakir are taking the attack especially hard because it's a place that many Turkish Kurds call home, including two high-profile Kurds who were killed in the bombing. Jacob Resnick is on the line from Diyarbakir.
Well, things are quite tense here. There's a lot of anguish for the people that were lost in Ankara. There's a lot of dismay. And right now, Diyarbakir is actually also burying its own dead. Today, there was a funeral that had a prominent political candidate from a pro-Kurdish party and an elderly peace activist known locally as, I guess you could translate it as Mother Miriam. And they were both killed in Ankara on Saturday. Aside from that, between, I'm told, 6 and 8 people have been killed in the city since Saturday.
What are those deaths about?
Well, since July, the ceasefire between the Turkish military and the PKK has broken down. And so there are regular clashes, and it's gotten pretty bloody. The deaths are in the hundreds. So we've had attacks on Turkish police, Turkish military, basically security forces in uniform by the guerrilla group. And then harsh retaliations by armored vehicles and also aircraft, not only in southeastern Turkey here where I am, but also in the PKK bases in northern Iraq. And so as people were mourning their dead, F-16s were buzzing right overhead. And at one point it was pretty, I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, when you have the sound of mourners being drowned out by the roar of jet engines. I don't know exactly why they were flying so low at that time, you know, in the middle of broad daylight like that. I don't know if it was meant to be a provocation, but the people on the ground certainly perceived it to be that way.
The rally in Ankara where the suicide bombings took place, it was not a pro-Kurdish rally, but there were a lot of Kurds there. Do people in Diyarbakir believe the Kurds were targeted in the suicide bombing or that this was ISIS coming into Turkey and wreaking havoc?
They believe that they were specifically targeted, and I'll tell you why. This was billed as a peace meeting. That's exactly what it was called, Barış Meeting. And it was basically a protest against the government continuing to, or basically the government rejecting the PKK's offer of a ceasefire.
So after the bombing in Ankara, apparently the Turkish government hit PKK targets with airstrikes. What do people in Diyarbakir think of that kind of response?
They see it as totally counterproductive. It would be oversimplification to say that the PKK doesn't represent anybody or does represent all Kurds. You know, of course, there's lots of gray areas here. But for the most part, what the main mandate we've seen from the election results in June is people, they want peace. And when you have one side of the combatants, you know, saying, hey, let's lay down arms and go back to talking to each other, and the other says flat out no, and then you have a horrific attack like that against civilians and the whole country's in shock, there's a lot of head scratching of like you just go back on the offensive.
Where is Prime Minister Erdogan in all of this? Do the Kurds in Diyarbakir feel like he has their back?
That's a really good question. I wish I knew. It's really interesting, Marco, because Mr. Erdogan is a big television star in Turkey, and he has 1 hour, 2 hour speeches carried live on afternoon television, you know, a few times a week. He has not spoken publicly since this bombing attack. And that is really, really odd, I think. He's put out some statements condemning the attack, but all the FaceTime with the cameras has been Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu. He's not seen as a very powerful figure in Turkey. He's kind of seen more as a top lieutenant or a deputy of Erdogan, even though he is the prime minister. So no, Erdogan has been keeping a very, very low profile. And that raises, I think, a lot of questions. When a country is faced with such something so horrific, and would you think would want to have a come together and heal or have some leadership, you know, the top man is nowhere to be seen.
Reporter Jacob Resnick there in Diyarbakir, Turkey. Turkey may be condemning ISIS now, but Turkey's relationship with ISIS has been pretty complicated. I spoke with Ayman Al-Tamimi today. He's a specialist on Islamic militant groups and a fellow with the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum. So, Ayman, the Islamic State was long a player in Iraq, even before it was called ISIS. Remind us when it became a player in Syria.
Officially, it became a player in Syria when it announced itself as ISIS in April 2013. Likely, though, there had been some agitations going on the ground within Syria for some months before that. But in terms of how ISIS and its relation with Turkey, how that played out, that really only comes to light in 2013 as ISIS is expanding across northern Syria. And then in particular, you see this large influx of foreign fighters crossing in from Turkey, the majority of them joining ISIS.
Yeah, so what was Turkey's attitude about all of this at the time?
Yeah, at the time it didn't really care at best, because early on in ISIS's existence in northern Syria, there broke out extensive fighting with Kurdish forces. And at the time also, a lot of rebel groups within Syria threw their lot in with ISIS in terms of fighting against and expelling Kurdish militias from a variety of localities across northern Syria. But Turkey's attitude then was like that of the rebels. At worst, it just saw ISIS as a lesser evil. So accordingly turned a blind eye to the very apparent growth in its strength that was partly derived from the policy of such loose and open borders, which allowed for the influx of so many fighters and weaponry to ISIS. So that was gross negligence, is the least you can say about it.
Yeah, Turkey didn't really care. What about other people who are now in the coalition, like the United States? Were they worried?
Yes, they were, but verbal pressure really didn't amount to much. In truth, really, the tightening of borders only came very recently, when it became clear that ISIS, suspected ISIS role in bomb attacks in southern Turkey that killed numerous people. So this border tightening is something really of the past few months. The policy before March, say, of this year, really was that anyone could cross provided they could prove they were in Turkey legally. It's how I crossed into northern Syria in December of 2014. I just went straight up to the official border crossing and showed them my passport and showed them my Turkish visa, and then it really wasn't much of a problem at all to cross in. So if that was the policy of the official borders, then you can see how lax I think security was.
Yeah. Why did it take so long for Turkey to take the ISIS thing seriously?
I think the two things, firstly, was the conflict, is the conflict with Kurdish forces. And it seems like Turkey sees both of them as equal threats. Secondly, ISIS never really threatened until recently, you know, direct attacks on Turkey. In fact, it was very apparent their policy was to avoid that kind of confrontation.
So how serious is the Turkish crackdown on ISIS now? I mean, are they trying to have it, like the U.S. trying to have it both ways, oppose ISIS and keep boots off the ground?
Yeah, that's the problem, I think. You trying to have it both ways of a no-ground intervention and then just talking. It inadvertently helps ISIS, or even if you can say that, I think it is true that Turkey has tightened the border security, and secondly, that Turkey has cracked down on ISIS networks within Turkey itself. But then, on the other hand, when you look at the airstrikes, Turkish airstrikes overwhelmingly targeted the Kurds, Kurdish militants, and not ISIS.
Tell me this, is there concern or anger in Turkey now, looking back at how their government may have had a role in allowing this ISIS monster to grow?
Yes, I think there is that sense that Turkey has sown the seeds of this problem. But I prefer to use blind eye as the term to describe Turkish policy towards ISIS at that point.
Ayman Al-Tamimi with the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Not a kingpin, but a queenpin in the illegal ivory trade gets nabbed in Tanzania. Later, here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, the radio show. I say that because we also have a language podcast. It's called The World in Words. And each week we tackle a new language story. This week, it gets personal.
In English, Nana, tell me.
In English, so?
What is your name?
Well, I don't know the name of him.
No, your name. What is your name?
Tanya.
Okay.
The world's Nina Porzuki talking with her grandmother, Tanya Porzuki. This is her story.
Growing up, I had no problems communicating with my grandmother. She speaks English and Polish and Russian and German and Yiddish and Hebrew and a bit of Lithuanian. But a few years ago, she had a series of strokes and then dementia set in.
What do you remember?
None.
Nothing?
No. И делала так, чтобы можно было.
This is gibberish. My grandmother's languages have gotten all mixed up. She's stuck in this linguistic fog, and nobody in my family can really find our way through. Not one of us speaks Polish or Russian or whatever combination of languages that she's been speaking. My father...
Hello.
Hello, good morning. Her only son has learned a couple of words.
Well, you know, my mother always said that when people revert to some language, the words that they really usually know are the kind of the curse words. There's a couple of curse words that she uses.
Oh, no.
Especially when she's upset or mad. She'll use the word dupa.
Dupa.
And I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but it means ass.
So the grandmother that I could always communicate with, the voracious reader, the one who told me that I hadn't really lived until I read Dostoevsky in Russian, could no longer speak to me in anything but. And I began to be curious. What was happening inside her brain that made the Russian and the Polish reappear, and the English that she had spoken for the largest part of her life, really, recede? This, it turns out, is a very difficult question to answer. But there have been a series of studies about the effects of bilingualism on dementia. One seminal study found that being bilingual might even stave off the symptoms of dementia for years.
It was totally to our amazement to discover a 4.5-year difference in the average age of symptom onset, simply as a function of whether or not these people were monolingual or bilingual. And that's a huge difference.
This is Ellen Bielstock, a psychology professor at York University in Canada. And in 2007, she published the formative study on bilingualism and dementia. She analyzed the medical records of bilinguals and monolinguals in Toronto. She looked at a set of people, all diagnosed with dementia, to see when they first showed recognizable symptoms. And what she found, that 4.5-year difference that she just spoke about, well, it created waves within the scientific community. Did you look into, like, the reasons why?
That's our main question. Why? What's going on? So we can speculate, but honestly, nobody really knows.
My brother is the 15th. Of in July the 25th.
1924?
No, 25.
My grandmother was born July 15th, 1925, in Vilnius, in what was then Poland. She learned how to read at a very young age. And one of the stories that she used to tell me was about two Polish spinster sisters who lived in her apartment building. They had this immense private library, and they lured her into their house one day and lent her a book. Now, I don't remember what book. I know she told me, but I didn't write it down. But this book sparked something inside her, turned her into a reader. The sisters kept feeding her one book after another, after another, after another. Ellen Bielstock says one speculation about the 4.5-year difference is that being bilingual helps to build up something that scientists call the, quote, cognitive reserve. Think of it almost like brain armor, like all those things they tell us are good for the mind, Sudoku, crossword puzzles. Learning another language contributes to this theoretical neurological weaponry, the cognitive reserve. But with loads and loads of caveats, says another neuropsychologist, Thomas Bach, at the University of Edinburgh. He was excited by Bielstock's study, and it seemed only natural why.
Thomas, first, how many languages do you speak?
Polish, German, English, French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese.
Bach replicated Bielstock's study in Hyderabad, India, and he got the same results. but he's equally in the dark as to exactly why they have found this 4.5-year difference. He does, however, have a theory. Bilinguals, in every interaction, have to choose which language to speak. This is exercising something called the frontal executive function.
The big difference in dementia is not so much about remembering things in terms of knowledge, it's about accessing this information.
Uh-huh.
So the bilinguals might also have, let's say, problems in forgetting something, but they will be better accessing it because of their better frontal executive functions.
When I asked Bach my original question, why has my grandmother chosen to fall back into one language and not another? He was perplexed. There isn't much, if any, scientific study as to why one language takes hold and other languages are lost to dementia. However, there are many, many anecdotes and case studies, he told me. Oh, and that noise you're about to hear in the background, that's his multilingual daughter. She only speaks 4 languages.
The oldest rule, which has been described by a Frenchman called Ribot in 19th century, is that people revert to their original language. A few years later, something else described by Pitre, so also in France, and he said, well, it might be the language which is mainly spoken for the last 10, 20 years of the life.
For my grandmother, it isn't. It isn't exactly her first language either. Her first language is Polish. And then later, when the Russians occupied Vilnius in 1939, Russian. Another theory, Bach told me, was that a person might revert to a language that they spoke during a moment in their life, in which they felt immense joy or satisfaction or comfort. I can't imagine that 1939 was a particularly calm time in my grandmother's life. She was 15. Europe was on the brink of war. And not to mention the hormonal war beginning inside her. But then perhaps this was one of the last times of her life when she truly felt comfort, when her family was still together, still in their same apartment building with the old Polish ladies lending her books. Perhaps this was when she started reading the Russians in Russian.
There are so many different aspects which play a role, and cognitive as well as emotional. So it's not that we are kind of making just, you know, computer decisions, the attitude that we have, the beliefs, the hopes.
Memory is unreliable at the best of times. And why our brain chooses to latch on to one thing or another, one language or another, there is something in that mystery that, and I don't mean to be dramatic, but it's almost poetic. When I think about my grandmother's deteriorating mind, her memories evaporating, Of course she's retreated back into a language and a moment before the disappearing in her life began. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucki.
This is just a snippet of Nina's story. To listen to the entire piece, including more details on Bach's dementia study in India, subscribe to the World in Words podcast on iTunes. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yang Fenglan moved to Tanzania from China in the 1970s. She became a pillar of the business community, but now...
She's been accused of smuggling 700 tusks from elephants in Tanzania to China in the past 15 years.
The story of the so-called Ivory Queen coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with The World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've seen the heat Hillary Clinton has been taking for not being spontaneous enough on the campaign trail, for appearing too stiff and not being herself. But at least she's not facing questions about why, as a woman, she's even in the race. That's what many women politicians in Japan still have to deal with, and worse. Last year, a representative in the Tokyo Assembly became the focus of a sexual harassment scandal that rocked the country. Reporter Naomi Gingold checks in to find out what's changed for her and for other women politicians there.
The resumes of most politicians do not read like Ayaka Shiomura's. She graduated from a junior college and then worked in the entertainment world. Later, she studied abroad and says that experience really changed her. Before, I was the kind of girl you wouldn't know if I were there or not. I didn't assert myself at all. But being abroad, she learned how to say what needed to be said. And since coming back, people often tell her, you're really strong. You stand your ground. Shiomura then became a scriptwriter for TV and radio. At one point, she worked on a radio show with a segment on politics. And there, she started to meet and talk to politicians. And she realized that if she wanted better policies for the issues she cared about, she would have to run. In 2013, she was elected to the Tokyo Municipal Assembly as a member of the Young Your Party. Her job was hard from the beginning. Because I'm first term, because I'm young, because I'm a woman, from a lot of perspectives, there's still a lot of prejudice and discrimination in the assembly. And especially as a young woman, I'm taken lightly and I don't feel respected. Last summer, Shiomura addressed the assembly for the first time, talking about the need to do more to support working women who have or want to have kids in order to bring up the country's low birth rate. In the middle of her speech, members of Prime Minister Abe's ruling LDP party started heckling her, with taunts of, wouldn't it be better if you just hurried up and got married? Maybe you can't have babies. On TV, viewers saw shaken Shiomura quickly finish and dab her eyes. Heckling and even sexual harassment is not uncommon in the Tokyo Assembly, Japanese politics, or Japan. But Shiomura did something unusual. She asked the Assembly to identify and punish those responsible. They didn't. They wouldn't, and the issue blew up in international and then Japanese media. Some pointed to Shiomura's past, hosting a late-night TV show wearing only a bathing suit, and said, this kind of woman, she deserves it. But most public reaction towards the hecklers was harsh. Finally, one LDP politician claimed responsibility and apologized on national TV. But no others came forward, and the assembly voted down a call to identify the rest. Lawmakers created a commission to look into gender discrimination in the assembly, but that commission hasn't produced anything yet. And now, a year on, Shiomura has been ostracized by everyone. Not a single legislator will work with her. It's kind of like what you see in elementary school. Some people have told me in secret that if they're seen talking to me, they will be treated badly. Because she is seen as the one who caused problems, who made a big fuss over nothing. Shiomura says the message from all of this is, if a woman stands out, do you see what'll happen? No one will work with her? I don't even know what that means. It's not true. Hiroshi Shigihara is with the majority LDP party in the Tokyo Assembly. The LDP treats every member of the assembly equally, according to the rules, and everyone has the opportunity to speak. So maybe it's not surprising that Shiomura and others question the LDP's ability to actually change and their sincerity.
Quota is the best solution to increase women's representation in Japan.
Professor Mikiko Eto studies women in politics in Japan. Right now, Japan has the lowest representation of women in politics in the developed world. That's why both she and Shiomura think a quota is the best way to go. But Eto says that kind of legislation is basically dead in the water. It'd be really hard to introduce a quota here as long as the LDP is in power, because they're completely against it. And the LDP has only briefly lost power twice since the end of World War II. There's a lot Ayaka Shiomura still wants to accomplish in her job, but she says, there's a limit to how much I can fight against something so big. She says the point of getting elected was not so that she could be a politician. It was so that she could do something for the issues she cared about. If no one will work with her, how much can she do? For the world, I'm Naomi Gingold, Tokyo, Japan.
Well, here's a woman with undisputed clout. Yang Feng Glan has been called the Queen of Ivory, the most notorious trafficker of elephant tusks in the world, and now she's been caught. The 66-year-old grandmother was arrested by Tanzanian police. This is a country in East Africa that's been the axis for elephant poaching in the whole continent. Ruth McLean has been covering this story for the Times of London. What can you tell us about Yang Fenglan, Ruth? Who is she and where is she from?
She's been living in Tanzania since the 1970s, and she's quite a respectable-seeming businesswoman. She's the owner of a very popular restaurant in Dar es Salaam. But underneath all that, she is accused of smuggling 700 tusks from elephants in Tanzania to China in the past 15 years.
Right. Over a 15-year period, how long had the authorities been following her?
They've been following her for about a year. She was caught with ivory traveling through her kitchen of the restaurant that she ran. And then, you know, they surrounded her house and waited for her. And eventually there was a high-speed car chase through the center of Dar es Salaam. And eventually, you know, she had to stop and got out and put her hands up.
How big of a catch is she? I mean, is her arrest going to make a dent in the illegal ivory trade business?
Well, conservationists are saying that she's a very big catch indeed, and they hope that she's going to lead to a lot of other arrests as well. It's big money that we're talking about, millions and millions of dollars worth. Unfortunately, you know, 700 tusks just means about 350 elephants. That's a very small amount compared to the number that have been poached. We're talking tens of thousands here. I mean, there's been about a 60% drop in elephants across Africa, and a lot of those have been killed in Tanzania, which is a huge safari destination and home to, you know, significant populations.
And could we possibly see an increase in the elephant population now?
Maybe eventually this could lead to rising numbers of elephants again, but I don't think we should underestimate the poaching gangs either. You know, they move very quickly. They're a bit like the drug gangs working in Latin America, and they find new people and new routes all the time. They have lots of money and they're well armed, and I don't know if this one arrest will be enough to really put them off.
Do we know who her buyers were? Were they artisans who do carving or traditional healers who claim tusk has medicinal properties?
We think probably both in China, but we're not sure. I mean, that's what the police is doing at the moment. They're trying to track the passage of this ivory through Africa to China, because ivory is a big status symbol in China. You know, there's a growing middle class, and it's very fashionable in some circles to have a tusk or something beautiful made out of a tusk on your mantelpiece, for instance. There is some use of it in traditional Chinese medicine. That certainly does have an impact. But I think really it's the status symbol that conservationists are most worried about, because that's spreading, and more and more people are getting to the level where they can afford to buy what is a very expensive product and a legal product.
Will she become an example for Tanzania and other African governments? I mean, is she going to face a stiff prosecution as a result of all this?
I think she may well. I mean, she faces 30 years in jail if she's convicted. That would take her to the age of 96 if she lives that long. It's a really good sign that Tanzania is actually starting to take this seriously. I mean, one of the criticisms that conservationists have leveled at Tanzania in particular is that officials have been accused of collaborating with the poaching gangs. There is allegedly a lot of corruption, and, you know, the fact that they are pursuing this prosecution now might mean that they're willing to take on the corrupt officials in Tanzania's government who are accused of being involved in and profiting from this trade.
Ruth McLean with the Times of London, thanks very much for telling us about Yang Fenglan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The debate over the hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants entering Europe often gets reduced to dollars and cents. We can't afford to allow more people in when we can't employ the people already here. The people coming and what they've been through and why they're coming to Europe often get trumped by the money argument. But here's a story about a group of West Africans in Italy who, if given a work permit and some fresh milk, are showing locals just how they can contribute. Angelica Marin has a story from Rome.
Across the street from an auto repair shop, crates of zucchini, potatoes, lettuce, and tomatoes are on display at a kind of pop-up market.
Bit more, a little more. I can give them more.
That's Seydou, 26 years old, from Gambia. He gets giddy when shoppers fight for the remaining jars of his yogurt.
For these people, it's very good. My yogurt is very good. They know the yogurt is better. They know it's natural.
It's not just natural or organic or farm to table. This yogurt is a symbol of hope, made, jarred, and delivered by a group of West African immigrants. Their business idea came from far, far away, through a dangerous route.
From Gambia, Senegal, from Senegal to Mali, from Mali to Niger, from Niger to Libya, from Libya to Italia.
Seydou traveled 3,000 miles across the desert and sea to get to a country that pretty much allows African immigrants to do one job, brutal agricultural labor. But 7 years later, he's part of a successful cooperative, African yogurt delivered to homes, markets, and restaurants on bicycles. The founder of the operation, Suleiman Diara, pulls up on one of the bikes. He's the one who saw the opportunity, put a skinny African cow on a yogurt label, and named the co-op. It's from the Bambara language of his native Mali.
Barikama. The project was called Barikama, which means resilient. Resilient because it began with two people and 2 liters of milk a week. When we reached 200 liters a week, we decided to call ourselves Barikama because we had potential to grow. We got this far, facing all these problems, and we believe we can resist, grow, and help other people.
Suleiman says his first years in Italy were harsh. Like thousands others who came undocumented, Suleiman fell prey to agricultural exploitation in Italy's south, picking mandarins for 5 cents a case. He ended up in Rosarno, a town with a bad reputation for violence against immigrants. Seydou was also there, and other Africans who would become the Barikama team. Now they gather in a tiny dairy lab near a lake in the very pretty Roman countryside. Today, two of Suleiman's partners are on shift. Sheikh from Senegal, dressed in full cheese factory garb, along with rings and bracelets. And Ismail from Benin, a soft-spoken accountant with wide glasses that keep steaming up from the heat. Sheikh pours organic milk into a steel tank. Ismail stirs it with a big wooden spoon. They say this yogurt has changed their lives. Here's Ismail.
We're really happy to carry on with this project because we're independent now. We don't have to beg anyone, and we're free to organize our own work without exploitation. We understand each other, and we do everything together.
Ismail had a good job in Italy, but he got laid off and lost his permit to stay. He went under the radar and kept working so he could support his family back in Benin. He became a day laborer in Rosarno. Sheikh had a visa to audition with a professional soccer team, but didn't make the cut. Rather than going home empty-handed, he stayed and picked tomatoes in Rosarno. Sheikh remembers that time bitterly.
Those who know Rosarno know it's a racist place. If an African buys an espresso at a cafe, they give it to you in a plastic cup. Instead, they serve it to white people in a proper espresso cup. You can't walk around at night because people throw rocks at you and drivers slam the doors of their cars open to hit you. Total racism.
In Rosarno, migrants live in shacks without running water. They work 12 hours a day for no more than $25. And a big chunk of it goes to local recruiters. African day laborers who flee their countries to escape poverty, not wars, swarm the Italian coast and countryside without a chance of ever obtaining asylum. Experts say Italy treats them as if they were a problem, but farm owners are perfectly happy to exploit them as cheap labor. Suleiman says the Italian system is totally unfair, but Italian people, for the most part, have been supportive.
Everything I lived through was bad, but also good, because I really understood the meaning of humanity. Always try to help the other, and give support to someone who doesn't have your same opportunities.
Like the woman who sponsored their first batch of milk, or the farmer who offers his professional dairy lab for free. Not to mention the passionate yogurt customers.
Barikama.
It's all about Barikama, Suleiman says.
Barikama.
Resilience. For The World, I'm Angelica Marin, Rome.
This is The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Remember MH17? That was the Malaysian airliner flying between Amsterdam and Kuala Lumpur. It was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine last summer, 2014. All 298 people on board, mostly Dutch, died. Dutch investigators have been piecing together what happened, and they'll issue a long-awaited report tomorrow. My BBC colleague Anna Holligan has been speaking with some of the relatives and investigators. How'd they zero in on what caused the crash, Anna? I mean, this has been 15 months in review.
It has, indeed. And as you say, long awaited by those relatives. It's important, Marco, to make it very clear from the outset that this is a technical report. So the more politically charged question of who did this, who was responsible, is being dealt with by a separate criminal investigation, which is expected to conclude by the end of this year. With regards to what caused the crash, that's the first question that's being addressed by the Dutch Safety Board. And they are expected to confirm the widely held suspicion that flight MH17 was most likely shot down by a Buk missile.
So a Buk missile, is that a Russian missile?
A Buk missile is a Russian-made missile indeed. But our understanding is that possibly both sides had access to these missiles. So the Dutch Safety Board report will probably stop before going into any kind of detail about where it came from or where it was fired from, because that could potentially prejudice the criminal investigation. And that will be hugely frustrating for the relatives who I've spoken to, because they want the whole story. They want to know not just what caused the crash, but who did it, who was responsible for those 298 deaths.
I gather investigators were also looking at the final moments of this flight. I mean, there are local farmers who saw people fall out of the sky in Ukraine that day. And what are the relatives expecting to hear from this report?
It's unimaginable to think what they might have seen there on the ground on that day. The Dutch Safety Board has told us that they are taking the unusual step of addressing this question after receiving a specific request from the next of kin. The families who I've been speaking to say they don't want to know if their relatives were conscious or aware in those final moments. They would rather not know about it. They would rather stick to what they imagine and what they've made peace with. So, for example, I've been speaking to a father of a 17-year-old girl. Her name is Elsemeek de Borst. And Hans, her father, says that she would have had her headphones in. She would have been watching a movie like Lord of the Rings. That she would have had her knees propped against the chair in front of her. And he thinks she just wouldn't have known anything. And that's how he's been able to make peace with it. I think it's highly unlikely that the report will reach any kind of conclusive conclusion as to whether the passengers and the crew were aware in those final moments. And the thing is, it's still a mystery, because the flight data recorder, the voice recorder, they all stopped at 1320 GMT. And that's the time that the plane is thought to have been hit. Mm. So it may be that they just never know.
Yeah, such are the grim details that families don't want to hear about, but the things they do want to know. I mean, will we ever really know who did it? I mean, won't that be the real beginning of some kind of justice for the families?
That's the big question. Where did the missile come from? Who fired it? And that will indeed be the beginning of the judicial process. But so many questions are, for now, unanswered.
My colleague with the BBC, Anna Holligan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, some fun from Bermuda. The island is known for its beaches of ultra-fine sand, perfect for building sand sculptures. Reporter Alex Galifant was on the island for the 20th annual sand sculpture competition and tells us it was a great one.
The sculptures take place on Horseshoe Bay on the southern side of Bermuda. First thing in the morning, organizers form the plots. Big piles of sand marked by 10 by 10 squares of string. That's what competitors get to work with. Jamal Hart is master of ceremonies. He works for Bermuda's Department of Youth, Sport and Recreation.
They're actually competing for a purse prize of $2,000, split amongst four different categories.
There's children, teenagers, an open category,
which consists of individuals, companies, organizations, and then we have the tourist category.
Before you ask, no, I did not compete, but Jamal still let me in on what makes a winning sand sculpture.
What the judges are looking for is originality, creativity, full use of the lot, and, you know, detail. If you're saying you're going to build a mermaid and it looks more like a dinosaur, you know, those things could go against you.
You get 7 hours to build something special. Hart has seen some quality work in his time.
The reigning champion, she produced one that was called A Whale of a Time, and it was a sperm whale fighting with a humpback whale.
The champion was back for this year's contest. Her name is Hannah Emerson Strang. Born and bred in Bermuda, Hannah knows the sand like the back of her hand. She begins by dumping buckets of water onto her plot.
And packing the sand until it sounds pretty much like that, like a solid thwack, and that's how you know your sand is hard-packed and it's safe to carve.
And to carve the sand, Hannah brings a cornucopia of tools.
In my bag of tricks is a spray bottle to wet down your detail, is an artist palette knife, because the sharp edge, you can use a steak knife, but your mother might not appreciate you stealing her knives. A chopstick, sharpened at one end, if I can. And my most favorite one is a straw to blow out the detail work.
After hours of work, the sculptures are complete, around 20 in total. There's a ship being consumed by a terrifying sea python. There's a memorial to Trayvon Martin. Emerson's effort, built with a partner, is a tribute to Cecil the Lion. The sand camera in front of his head carries her message.
The proper way to shoot animals is with a camera, not with a rifle. Like, really, dude?
Further up the beach, two local kids, Monty and Elsie, are showing off their literary effort.
Well, we did wild things.
And we put on, like, a kind of quote that says, "Oh, please don't go, we'll eat you up, we love you so."
Yeah, so this is the boat, and this is the waves, and there's Max, and his boat's got his name on it. And that's the big one. Yeah, that's the king of the wild things.
And in first place for breaking rights in the family category, we have on plot number 13, the wild things.
We got $250.
What are you going to do with it?
We're going to go on a boat. We're going to go on a boat trip for 4 hours. And we're also going to get ice cream.
And no surprises in the overall category.
Treasures, not trophies. So save our wildlife.
No one begrudges Hannah another win, probably because she teaches sand sculpture too. Many of her competitors are also her students.
I'm so proud.
For The World, I'm Alex Galifant, Bermuda.
Don't forget to clean your shoes, Alex. That's all from us today at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.